Let's have the Judiciary Committee come to order. It is 1:35 on the afternoon of Wednesday, March 25th, 2009. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator McGuire is here, Senator French and my, and Senator Wilikowski. Today we have with us Dr. Andre Rose from the University of Alaska Justice Center. I'm really thankful to have you with us. I came across some of your work. I've been coming across your work for some time, but something that really caught my eye was this report that came out last summer. And it has two fascinating articles in it, one about case attrition and the other about a victimization study regarding sex assault. And we, as a committee, have been looking into this topic for some time now, sort of trying to gather as much information as possible. We had a good presentation earlier in the year about the use of polygraphs on convicted sex offenders. But one of the things that jumped out at me from your study was that, you know, of the, say, 1,000 reported rapes, you get about 200 convicted sex offenders. And I began to think, you know, if we just focus on those 200 people, that still leaves as many as 800 other cases out there that are still, you know, individuals who could be victimizing Alaskans. So with that, I'll turn it over to you, let you introduce yourself to the committee, put yourself on the record, and go ahead and begin your presentation. We discussed in the as we began that we would probably just raise our hands and pop in and ask questions as we go along so that we can have a friendly dialogue with you. So again, welcome to the committee, and please go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Andre Rose. I'm the interim director of the Justice Center at the University of Alaska Anchorage. So what I have for you today is a presentation based on research that we've done over the last 5 years. You should all have also a packet of information. On the right-hand side, we've included reprints from the Alaska Justice Forum. We basically included anything that we've done on sexual assault, stalking, and domestic violence within the last 5 years. Then on the left side, you also have a copy of the PowerPoint presentation. And then way on the back is a list of effective criminal justice responses that we've identified through our research. These are the little footnotes and details that will back up some of the claims that I'll be making towards the end of the presentation. Before I begin, I do want to acknowledge some of the funding that we've received for this research. That includes funding from the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, from the National Institute of Justice, and then also from the University of Alaska Anchorage. I will talk about primarily four sets of studies that we've done. The first is with Alaska State Troopers, and I want to thank Commissioner Masters and Colonel Holloway, who is here today, for their interest in working with us. We've also done studies with the Anchorage Police Department, primarily with Chief Monaghan and Chief Hune, then with sexual assault nurse examiners throughout the entire state of Alaska, and then also with the Alaska Department of Law with Susan Park and Rick Svobondi. One of the conclusions that I will make here is that one of the greatest assets that we have here in Alaska is we have an extremely strong criminal justice system that most of the time does work quite well. And one of the real benefits that we have is a presence of agencies who is truly interested in examining what they're doing and how they could improve. And so I'll get back to that towards the end. So here are data from the Uniform Crime Reports. And I know we talked very briefly at the beginning about what's the difference between the Uniform Crime Reports and the National Crime Victimization Survey. So let me begin with the Uniform Crime Reports. These are offenses that are known to police, and these statistics are only about forcible rape, defined as the carnal knowledge of a female forcibly and against her will. Other forms of sexual assaults are not included, and I'll talk a little bit about that in a few minutes. Here you see the rates for Alaska in red, Anchorage in green, Fairbanks in light blue, and then for the U.S. overall in dark blue from 1996 to 2007. And so clearly what you can see here is that we have a rather long history of being persistently above the U.S. average. And we can go back even more and you would see the same differences. It's very hard to see that, and the difference is not significant, but if you look from 96 to 07, you actually see a slight decline in the U.S. rate, whereas overall you tend to see a slight increase in Alaska and in Anchorage. And the data for Fairbanks, I should have mentioned, Fairbanks started to participate, or the statistics were available for Fairbanks starting in 2003. So that's why we don't have any data prior to 2003.
And that's gathered through their local police department, I'm going to guess.
Correct, through the FBI.
Thank you. Senator Wilikowski has a question.
Yeah, not to pick on Fairbanks, but why, any theories on why Fairbanks is double, really, Anchorage and Alaska as an average?
None at this point. The studies that we've done focus primarily on the Anchorage Police Department and the Alaska State Troopers. So these would be offenses that are reported to the Fairbanks Police Department, and at this point, I couldn't possibly tell you.
And maybe Senator McGuire has a question. Go ahead, and then we'll get to the National Crime Victimization Studies.
Yeah.
Senator McGuire.
Through the chair, we were discussing this morning on the airplane the idea that it will fetter out later on that remote locations of communities tends to be a driving factor in sexual assault and sexual abuse, particularly of minors. And I don't know this, but perhaps as you continue your work through the next couple of years, as Senator Wilikowski pointed out, identifying not only why Alaska is unique and why we're higher so that we can begin to address the issues, but then within the state itself, the regions and their particular rates, what about those factors might make it higher or lower so that, again, individual efforts can be made at the local levels too?
Yes, through the chair, you'll see some interesting data from the Copper River Delta, where you will see astronomically high rates of violence against women, and I'll show you that in a few minutes.
Please proceed.
Okay. So to summarize this graph in terms of numbers, if we look at the averages from 2003 to 2007, the rate in Alaska for forcible rape was 2.6 times higher than the U.S. average. The rate in Anchorage was 2.84 times higher, and then in Fairbanks, it was 5 times higher than the U.S. average. And again, that's been persistently true at least since 1996. And again, if you went back 10 years, 20 years before that, that was still true. Another way to look at this is to look at the crime clock. There were 90,427 forcible rapes that occurred in the U.S. in 2007. So that means on average it would be one every 6 minutes. In Alaska, that would be one every 17 hours. In Fairbanks, one every 8.5 days. And then in Anchorage, one every day and a half. So it's a rather large volume of cases. And again, we're only talking about forcible rape in these statistics.
Let me ask another question, and I know this is, we're sort of straying from, I think, the body of your work, but you just have to ask, you know, what is it? It's building on the questions that Senator McGuire and Senator Wilikowski both asked. What is it about our state that prompts such horrific rates? And as I've puzzled on that, I've thought, you know, is it our geographic isolation? Is it the high amount of alcohol? Is it a combination of factors? And yet, as I think about that, I think there's other states and places in the world that are similar to Alaska. They're western states like Montana. They're small population states where a few, because we're such a small population state, 20 or 30 rapes is going to make it look much worse statistically. But, I mean, if you have any thoughts on what it is about Alaska that makes us so uniquely bad in this topic, I would love to hear your thoughts.
I'm afraid I don't have too many thoughts about that, other than you're absolutely correct. It is a combination of a wide variety of factors. What we have determined, though, through some of our research is how we can address some of those factors and what we can do to make a difference. I'll show you some strategies that really have been shown to make a difference, not just at a national level, but here locally in Alaska, where things may be a little bit different than they are in other places. One of the other states that has a very high rate of forcible rape is Michigan. If you compare Michigan to Alaska, there's pretty striking differences between those two states. The other one is New Mexico, which does have some of the isolation factors, and so that might be more comparable to what we have here in Alaska.
And maybe this is the time to get you to just clear up the record about the difference between reported rapes, which we're talking about here, uniform crime reports derived from the FBI, all sort of filtered through law enforcement, and unreported rapes, the rapes that don't get reported to the police, and how we account for them.
Let me get to that just in a couple slides.
I'll let you wait. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. here's another chart showing the prevalence of forcible rape in Alaska. Alaska is on the right-hand side. The U.S. is on the left. If we look just at violent crime, which in what are called the Part 1 offenses reported to the FBI. That includes murder, non-negligent manslaughter, aggravated assault, forcible rape, and robbery. And what we can see is that forcible rape is a much more common form of violent crime in Alaska than it is elsewhere. And that is a little bit unique, even if we compare that to the other states that have high rates of forcible rape, like Michigan and New Mexico. They tend to have high rates of violent crime overall. So forced labor is a much more common form of violent crime here in Alaska than elsewhere. These are the rates per 100,000 women, whereas the UCR usually reports these as per 100,000 people, but by their definition, only women can be victims of forcible rape. So here we're looking at the rates per 100,000 women, and so you can see that on average from 02 to 07, the rate was 169.4. One of the things that we're often asked about is what would it take to not be number one and to fall below number two? This is what it would take, and there's quite a bit of detail here. I'll just look at the average at the bottom. So on average, the rate is 169.4. On average, we have 541 forcible rapes in the state per year that are reported to law enforcement. In order to not be number one, on average, instead of 541, we would have to go down to 340 forcible rapes reported to law enforcement. That's a decrease of 201 forcible rapes, or a 30% decline in the number of reported forcible rapes.
Senator Wilkowski.
And if we did that, that would make us number two in the nation?
Through the chair, correct. That would make us number two. That's a pretty tough job. This would take a tremendous amount of work to lower the number of reported forcible rapes by 200. The good news, though, is that had we done so, we could have saved a tremendous amount of resources. If you take that 200 and then follow those cases through the system and assume about a 20% conviction rate, that would give you about 40 convictions. Multiply that by the average of 12 years that these individuals would spend incarcerated in prison and an average cost of about $44,000 per year, you're ending up with a $20 million savings per year had we been able to do this. Obviously, that's only including incarceration costs. It doesn't include law enforcement costs, doesn't include court costs or victim costs, which generally include both tangible costs, such as medical bills, and intangible costs, such as pain and suffering. So a lot of the strategies that I'll talk about towards the end of my presentation are not cheap. There is a cost associated with that. But one of the ways of looking at it is that the cost of doing nothing is actually going to be much greater than the cost of implementing some of the strategies that I'll be discussing. So I think we're now on to what's the problem with these statistics from the Uniform Crime Reports. First, they only include rapes that are reported to law enforcement. Rapes that are not reported are not included in these statistics. Nationally, I think I have the statistic later on, we know that about 48% of sexual assaults are reported to law enforcement. So 52% are not reported. So you could probably double all the numbers that I just talked about. But that's an unknown.
Although to be fair, that also includes the lower 48.
Correct.
Everywhere.
Yes.
Everywhere.
Yeah. You would double it everywhere.
Jump up. Right. Thanks. Go ahead. Senator McGuire.
Through the chair, and on that point, that would be another unique aspect to analyze is whether there are cultural factors unique to certain regions in Alaska that might actually increase that rate of unreported rapes. And again, I'm thinking cultural sensitivities. I'm thinking of smaller, even more isolated communities where if a rape is reported, there's the potential for retaliation or to be ostracized in a community. And that's what I really worry about is that 52% of the rapes are not reported in the lower 48, but I suspect it's higher in Alaska.
Maybe the doctor can tell us.
Through the chair, I unfortunately can. I'm really hoping that we will be able to tell you that in a couple of years and have a statewide victimization survey that would be able to address that and to identify what are the barriers to reporting and why is it that some victims are not reporting to law enforcement. I think your arguments may very well be true. There is also the possibility that because we have so many wonderful services here in the state of Alaska, perhaps victims are more willing to report here in Alaska than elsewhere. Whether that would be true in the most remote places of the state, it's anyone's guess.
So maybe you can tell us now how it is you go about determining the percentage of rapes that do not get reported.
The only way to do that is through victimization surveys, such as the National Crime Victimization Survey, which is a nationally representative telephone survey of about 50,000 households per year, where they ask questions about whether they've been a victim of a sexual assault, and then they also determine whether that sexual assault has been reported to law enforcement.
It's basically it's basically a polling service. It's a telephone
Absolutely.
Polling service that asks individuals, have you been the victim of this variety of crimes? And then they assemble that, compare that against the number reported, and come up with a factor.
Exactly.
And I guess it's just worth pointing out, because I was looking into this, you know, earlier this year, and I came across at least this sort of piece of information that sort of shed some lights on the strengths and weaknesses of that approach. And this is from Wikipedia, which is not the best source of information, but I think it's roughly true. It says, victimization surveys suffer from problems as they are perception surveys. In these surveys, people are asked if they are victims of crime without needing to provide any supporting evidence. In these surveys, it is the participant's perception or opinion that a crime occurred, or even their understanding about what constitutes a crime, that is being measured. And so it's the best we have, but it's probably still imperfect.
There are some limitations to the NCVS as well. One of the advantages, though, is the question usually, they don't ask you, have you been a victim of an aggravated assault? But it's
Right.
more behavior specific, and you'll see some of those questions here in a few minutes. There are limitations to the Uniform Crime Reports, to the NCVS, and to every single data point that I'm going to be showing you. But the consistent picture, though, that those statistics paint is that there is a severe problem with sexual violence in Alaska,
yeah.
and it has been a persistent problem for well over 20 years.
And I don't think anyone disputes you on that. But thanks, you know. But we can't hear it often enough. I mean, it's just going to be one of those things. There, you know, it's a constant drumbeat of bad information coming at us, and I think our response has to be, you know, every year we seem to try something a little different here in Juneau to see if we can finally get a handle on the problem. Go ahead.
So in addition to excluding rapes that are not reported to law enforcement, the UCR statistics do not include any information on statutory rapes. I know Senator McGuire talked about on the February 11th meeting with Commissioner Masters about sexual violence against children. I'll show you quite a few statistics on that. Those are not generally going to be included in the Uniform Crime Reports. Incapacitated rapes against victims who are incapacitated due to alcohol use, are not included. And again, I'll show you that we have quite a few of those here in the state of Alaska. They do not include rapes with male victims or other sex offenses, such as online enticement of minors. And then rapes with more serious offenses are also not included. So any rape that's committed in combination with a homicide would not be included in the statistics that I just showed you. In addition, we generally believe that the rankings across states are not true, really valid assessments, because they ignore all the factors that come together to predict rates of violence. So for instance, they do not take into account demographics such as age structures in various states. And we know that based on the statistics that I'll show you, offenders tend to be of a specific age. So if we have a state with a large proportion of the population in that age group, that might be one of the reasons why we would see a higher rate of forcible rape. So I'll show you two other sets of statistics. The first one will be on homicides and talk about what proportion of those were related to intimate partner violence. And then we'll look at some data from the National Victimization Survey and then the one that was done in the Copper River Delta. So in terms of homicides, these are data from the Alaska Violent Death Reporting System from 2003 to 2005. They captured information on 117 homicides. That represented about 20% of all violent deaths. The most common form of violence death was suicide. Looking at the 117 homicides, 22% of them were related to intimate partner violence. Most often, the victim was female. In 37.5% of the cases, the victim was male. One of the things that I'll talk quite a bit about is alcohol use, and you can see here that among victims that tested positive for alcohol use, 78% were above the legal limit.
And let me just get a clarification, if I could. How did you select these 117 homicides to look at? What was the criteria?
This is a project funded by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to the state. So this is not a study that we did.
I see.
This includes, I believe, all homicides in the state of Alaska from 2003 to 2005.
And so why is it 19% of all violent deaths?
The other ones would include suicide. That was the most common category.
Okay.
So they captured information on all violent deaths.
So there's five times as many suicides as there are homicides in Alaska? Is that, I'm getting head nods. Okay, thank you. I just didn't.
Our next issue of the Alaska Justice Forum.
Yeah.
Our next issue of the Alaska Justice Forum, we'll have an article on that. We'll talk about the prevalence of suicide and homicide. If we compare, this is from a national report looking at the percentage of homicides that were related to intimate partner violence in 17 states, although California did not include the entire state. But what you can see here is that Alaska and Utah lead the nation in the percentage of homicides that were related to intimate partner violence. So that was a more common form of homicide than we found in other states. So now moving to victimization surveys. This is a project that was done by Randy Megan with the School of Social Work and Daryl Wood, formerly with the UAA Justice Center. What they found in a survey of Alaska Native women in the Copper River Delta is that 64% of them reported being physically assaulted by an intimate partner at some point in their lifetime. That compares to a national average of 22%. This is a vast, striking difference between a national average and a local average.
And maybe, I mean, is this like Glen Allen, Copper Center? Can you tell me some of the other, I mean, is it Cordova? I mean, I'm just trying to get a feel for what part of the state we're talking about.
I have to get back to you, but I believe the answer is yes on
roughly
all of those.
Roughly in that area. Okay, thank you.
So if you compare the national victimization rate to the victimization rate for these Alaska Native women in the Copper River Delta, the lifetime victimization rate was almost three times higher than the national rate. And again, we see a consistent pattern with alcohol use, with 78% of perpetrators and 60% of victims having used alcohol prior to the assault. This is a detailed graph that shows you some of the questions that are utilized in the National Crime Victimization Survey. This is not all of the questions, but just a sample of them. And you can see in red are the survey responses for Alaska Native women in the Copper River Delta. And in blue are the national averages from the National Crime Victimization Survey. So looking at those numbers, you can see, starting at the bottom, if we look at victims who report being beat up, Alaska Native women in the Copper River Delta had a lifetime prevalence that was five times higher than the national average. For being hit with an object, the difference was, let me find my notes here, six times higher. For being choked or drowned or attempted drownings, the difference was five times higher. For being kicked or bit, the difference was four times higher. For being slapped or hit, a difference of five times. Pulled hair, a difference of four times. Pushed, grabbed, or shoved, an eight-time difference. And then throwing something that could hurt, a nine-time difference. So again, very big, large differences between what was found here locally and national averages. So overall, you know, I think what all of these data show is that we do have a fairly severe problem with violence against women, both in terms of physical assault, sexual assault, or if you look at homicides, all of the statistics, again, paint a rather persistent picture that our rates in Alaska are far higher than they are in national averages. I will say, in addition, that there is likely to be a difference in reporting, although we don't really know in which direction, and that the direction of that difference may vary across the state. But the difference between what we find in Alaska and what we find nationally is so great that it can't possibly be due just to a difference in reporting. There's something else that's going on here. So one of the things that we've done is to engage in four sets of studies to try to figure out what's happening and how can the criminal justice system better respond. So as I mentioned, the first set of study was the Alaska Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Study. I'll give you a little bit more detail in each one, and then I'll review some of the key findings that we have and some of the key policy implications that emerge from those studies. The second set was with the Alaska State Trooper Studies. The third set was a variety of studies with the Anchorage Police Department, and then finally some studies with the Alaska Department of Law. All of those studies are available on our website. Strong caveat here that all of the studies only include offenses that were reported to law enforcement, so we don't know anything about from these studies, we don't know anything about offenses that were not reported to law enforcement. These are also studies that are really about the criminal justice process. We don't have any studies based on prevention, and I know Senator McGuire, you talked about prevention at the last meeting when Commissioner Masters was here and the importance of that. We fully agree that prevention is a very important part of the response, but I won't say a whole lot about that because I'm really going to focus on the criminal justice response. Similarly, I'm not going to say a whole lot about the importance of victim advocacy. We know that they're critically important as a piece of the overall response, but these studies right here are really focused on police, courts, and corrections. So the Alaska Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Study was a study that we conducted in 8 locations in Kotzebue, Nome, Bethel, Soldotna, Homer, Kodiak, Anchorage, and Fairbanks. The vast majority of the cases came from Anchorage because we collected data in Anchorage from 1996 to 2004. We also collected about 100 cases from Bethel and Fairbanks because they participated for 2 years, and then a smaller number of cases from Homer, Kodiak, Kotzebue, Nome, and Soldotna. The data that we have on alcohol use, or the best data that we have, comes from the Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner Study. So you'll see very detailed measures of alcohol use coming from that study. With the Alaska State Troopers, we did a very thorough sexual assault study. If I recall correctly, the final report is at least 150 pages, maybe 200, and we've published little summaries of that report as well. We've also done a stalking study and a domestic violence study that was recently released, I think, in January. Again, all of those studies are about reported offenses only, and the AST studies do not include offenses that were reported to local or municipal departments, such as the Anchorage Police Department or the Fairbanks Police Department, or even some of the smaller ones throughout the state. In terms of the distribution of cases in the sexual assault study with AST, you can see here that almost half of the cases were from C detachment on the left-hand side. 49% of the sexual assaults reported to Alaska State Troopers are ones that occurred in C detachment. A smaller number, 16%, occurred in D detachment.
And again, though, I mean, my first reaction is to say, how can Anchorage, with half the state's population, be so low? And of course, the answer is because you are not counting cases developed by APD. This is strictly state trooper cases.
That is correct.
And what about the North Slope Borough? I can't see which detachment it belongs to from the construct of your slide.
I think I'm going to let Colonel Holloway answer that one.
All those cases are handled either by the borough police. I see. Okay, and we just don't. And that data wasn't part of your study or part of that study.
Correct.
Very good. Okay, thank you.
So the only thing that we included here were cases that were reported to the Alaska State Troopers.
So I mean, I guess just the last thing I'll say is it's very important not to sort of suddenly jump on the idea that half the cases in the state of Alaska are coming from Western Alaska.
Right.
Right. Thank
half
you.
Half of the AST workload in sexual violence comes from C detachment.
For AST. Right. Okay.
If we look at stalking cases, those were more just those were equally distributed throughout the state. If you look at B detachment, C detachment, D detachment, and E detachment. And then if we look at domestic violence cases throughout the state, we find the C detachment at 32% of the reports. And again, those are reports only to AST. 29% were to D detachment, 22% were to B detachment. And then everything is summarized here in the table. ABI cases, this is the Alaska Bureau of Investigation, at a relatively small number here because we're only including cases from the child abuse or cold case investigation units. All the other ones were attributed to the units that they came from. Obviously, we'll show you a lot more detail on the AST studies. Just a very brief note about the Anchorage Police Department studies. There, we only examined reports that were to the Anchorage Police Department. We've done 3 sets of studies for 2000 and 2001, for 2002 and 2003, and then the final one for 2004 to 2005. We've done a lot of work with APD. Some of it is to look at the location of contacts and assaults throughout the municipality of Anchorage. Here are just 2 examples of some of the maps that we've done. These results were pretty important from a policy perspective because one of the things that emerged through this was that the assaults that are occurring downtown are very, very different than the assaults that are occurring in Northeast, for example. And so how you intervene in those assaults is going to require a different response based on the differing nature of the assaults. Then in the Alaska Department of Law studies, which I'll summarize later on, well, we essentially look at 4 outcomes. First, we look to see whether the case was reported. We begin that with law enforcement. So we begin with a case that's reported to law enforcement. Then we look at Department of Law records to examine if the case was referred for prosecution, if it was accepted for prosecution, and if it resulted in a conviction. And one of the things that I should emphasize is that so far in all of the numbers that I'll show you today, we are looking at a conviction on any charge within that case. So it may be a plea bargain deal where we're dropping from a felony to a misdemeanor. It may even be on a non-sex offense charge, but we're counting any conviction at all as a success for now. So some of the key results that I'll go through, first we'll look at the gender, race, age, alcohol use, and relationship between victims and suspects, and we'll do that by looking at the sexual assault nurse examiner study, the AST studies, the APD studies, and the Alaska Department of Law studies will be used for examining the legal resolutions, again, whether cases were referred, whether they were accepted, and whether they resulted on any conviction on any given charge. So with gender, this is probably not too surprising, probably not all that interesting either, because I'm guessing you already know this. The vast majority of victims are female, the vast majority of suspects are male, and we find that to be true in every study that we've done. And that's consistent with national averages, nothing too striking or interesting there. These are data from the Alaska State Troopers looking at victims and suspects and their race in the sexual assault cases, in stalking cases, and in DV cases. And what you can see, at least for sexual assault, actually for all of them, for sexual assault, stalking, and domestic violence, the race of victims and suspects tends to be relatively similar, and I'll show you more details on that. The majority of the assaults were intra-racial, occurring within the same racial group, rather than interracial across racial groups. So for sexual assaults, about 59% to 60% of the suspects and victims were Native, 37% to 38% of the victims and suspects were white. For domestic violence, almost half of the suspects were Native, half were white, and then the exception there is for stalking, where the majority of both victims and suspects, 78% to 86% were white, and a relatively smaller proportion were Native. One of the things that we uncovered with stalking is that it's very likely to be an under-recognized offense and severely under-reported as well. So that's something that that I know AST is working on. If we look at the same information from the sexual assault nurse examiner study, here we compare Anchorage, Fairbanks, and then everything else, which we're including as rural. Not surprising, in the rural locations, 88% to 89%, the majority of both victims and suspects are Alaska Native. In Fairbanks, about half were Alaska Native, and then in Anchorage, we see a little more variation, with half of the victims being Alaska Native, but 37% of the suspects belonging to an other category, which is going to be primarily African American. But even in Anchorage, even in the sexual assault nurse examiner study, we still find that over half, just over half of the assaults were intra-racial rather than inter-racial. We can also look at four-year rates of sexual assaults reported to APD. So these are the APD data. This is looking at rates of reporting for a four-year average. And clearly you can see the Alaska Natives that have a significantly higher rate, with 20 per 1,000 in a four-year period. So a pretty striking difference there.
And how does that stand up to the generalization that most rapes are similar race suspect with similar race victim? I mean, it just seems like if that's true, then you must have this concurrently high rate of Alaska Natives committing these crimes. Is that right?
Yes, so this is for suspects now, and you can see that Alaska Native suspects did have a relatively high rate, not as high as black suspects, but overall, Alaska Native suspects were still more likely to assault an Alaska Native victim than anybody else. And so that information on suspect and victim race is summarized here in this table, and you can see, looking at all suspects, that in every single study, at least half of the assaults were intra-racial rather than inter-racial. And that was particularly true for Native suspects. They were even more likely to commit an intra-racial assault than an inter-racial assault than other suspects.
I'm hesitant to speculate out loud, but I guess one of the things that you think about is whether the and I'm sure we've got representatives here from the community that works with victims in this area, but you just wonder to what extent that's sort of counterintuitive, and so you just wonder whether the average female in Anchorage who is looking for a ride or looking for a way to get home doesn't pick someone that she's more familiar with and pick her own race, when in fact that's the more dangerous choice, if you see what I'm saying. It's just, I probably shouldn't speculate, but it's just something that comes to mind.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Okay, next we'll turn to age. So these represent the age of the sexual assault victims who were reported to the Alaska State Troopers. And here you can clearly see that the age of victims tends to be very young. I have the numbers. If you look at victims who are 0 to 5 and 6 to 12, 36% of the victims who reported to AST were 12 years of age or younger. 65% were 15 years of age or younger, and 74% were under 18. So almost three-quarters of the sexual assaults that are reported to Alaska State Troopers are assaults that are committed against minors. And as you'll see in the next graph, suspects tend to be significantly older than victims.
And do you have similar numbers for the APD studies?
Yes.
Thank you.
And the difference there is not as striking, but it's still there. You can still see that effect where victims tend to be younger than suspects. So I'll use, so the next one will show you the number of sexual assaults reported to AST by suspect age, and you can see that the most common category there was 20 suspects that were 21 to 30 years of age, followed by suspects that were 16 to 20 years of age. If we look at the combinations between victims and suspects in the sexual assault cases that were reported to the Alaska State Troopers, and we look at the five most common combinations between victims and suspects, that accounts for almost half of all the combinations that we find in the reports. And what you'll see then is that the most common AST case for sexual assault is one for a victim that's 0 to 12 years old who has been assaulted by a suspect who is 31 years of age or older. The next three most common combinations are for victims that are 13 to 15 years old who have been assaulted by suspects who are 16 to 20, 21 to 30, or 31 years of age or older. And then finally, the fifth category are for victims and suspects who are both 31 years of age or older. Those five combinations account for about half of the cases that AST sees on a yearly basis. Here are the data for APD for victims in blue and for suspects in red. These again are four-year rates within the reports, but these are rates per 1,000. So you can clearly see the highest rate are for 15 to 19 year olds. So the rate for 15 to 19 year olds in Anchorage was 15.4 per 1,000. And again, that's a four-year rate.
But that's not expressed in the same terms we saw just a couple of slides ago. You're not expressing it as a percentage of the total number of victims. That now you've switched measures.
Now we're looking at rates. So this is really about the risk of victimization for 15 to 19 years old. And you can see that 15 to 19-year-olds have the highest risk of victimization.
Thank you.
And those, if you're interested in the percentages, I'm sure we've included those in the Alaska Justice Forum in the packet. Those should be available there. These data on the age of victims are not entirely surprising, because if you link those to data from the 2007 Youth Risk Behavior Survey, we do find I don't know if they're high or not. I would consider them high rates of sexual violence and physical assaults. Those are the last two bullet points here. If we look at the 2007 survey, this is for 9th to 12th graders. These are students who are in school who have gotten parental consent to participate in the survey. We find that 9% report that they have been physically forced to have sexual intercourse when they did not want to. That's almost 10% of the students reported that that happened to them. 12% reported that they were hit, slapped, or physically hurt on purpose by their boyfriend or girlfriend at some point in the past 12 months. 45% said that they had sexual intercourse, 31% said they had sexual intercourse in the past 3 months, and again, we see this pattern with alcohol use, where 22% had used alcohol or drugs before their last sexual intercourse. So turning then to alcohol use, in the Anchorage Police Department studies that we've done, every single year from 2000 to 2005, over 60% of victims have used alcohol. In the Alaska Sexual Assault Nurse Examiner studies, over 65% of patients used alcohol in every single site except in Homer and Sultana, but you'll see the sample sizes in those sites was pretty small. We didn't have a whole lot of cases from those two sites. In the AST studies, we tend to see lower rates of alcohol use, with 27% of sexual assault victims using alcohol, 2% of stalking victims, and 32% of domestic violence victims using alcohol. A couple of things may be happening here. One is the victims, keep in mind, many of them were very young, less than 12 years of age. In addition, it's likely that reporting alcohol use is going to be less likely in the AST cases because of their young age and because it may also be illegal within those communities to have alcohol. So it may be less likely to be reported.
Thank you.
If we look at alcohol use by suspects, we find a fairly similar picture with sometimes higher rates. In the APD studies, every year over 70% of suspects have used alcohol. In the sexual assault nurse examiner studies, in every site, we find that over 75% have used alcohol, even in Homer and Soldotna, where we found lower rates of alcohol use among victims. And then in the Alaska State Trooper studies, we again find some slightly lower rates, but keep in mind some of the caveats that I just talked about. So we find that 43% of sexual assault suspects used alcohol, 20% of the stalking suspects, and 57% of the DV suspects had used alcohol. One of the benefits of the sexual assault nurse examiner study is we obtained very detailed estimates on alcohol use. Well, but I guess I'm not getting to that quite yet. That's coming in a couple more slides. First, this is looking at alcohol use by the age of the victim in the Alaska State Trooper cases. So we can see that among 13 to 15-year-old victims, 27% of them reported using alcohol. Again, it's likely that the percentage is actually much higher than that, but victims would not be willing to disclose that information for a wide variety of reasons. But at least we have a minimum of 27% reporting that they had used alcohol. And obviously, as you know, only the last two on the graph are legally able to consume alcohol. If we look at alcohol use by the age of the suspect, we find that among 21 to 30-year-olds, 34% of them had reported using alcohol, but even among the 16 to 20-year-olds, we find that 20%, one out of every five, reported using alcohol. And again, the true rates are likely to be higher, but we have a minimum of at least 20%. So now we're looking at alcohol use by sane location. You can see that in Kotzebue, every single victim reported using alcohol, but keep in mind that there were only 21 victims. Those are the numbers that are reported on the left-hand side. In Bethel and Fairbanks, where we had about 100 cases, 71% of victims reported using alcohol. In Nome and Anchorage, about 66 to 68%, and then Kodiak, Homer, and Soldotna had lower rates. One of the things that we measured in the sexual assault nurse examiner study was whether patients were incapacitated at the time of the assault, meaning whether they had passed out because of alcohol intoxication. And what you can see here is that in Kotzebue, 52% of the patients reported being passed out at the time of the assault. In Bethel, where we had 100 cases, 46% of patients reported being passed out at the time of the assault. Keep in mind also that none of those would be included in the uniform crime reports, because by their definition, this is not considered a forcible rape. So these are not going to be included. In Fairbanks, where we had 118 cases, almost a third of the cases were committed against patients who were passed out. And then in Anchorage, one out of every five, or slightly more than that, were with patients who had passed out prior to the assault. So very high rates of incapacitation. And I will point out just briefly that these rates tend to be higher The only national comparison that we have is a survey that was done for college students in the lower 48, and I can't remember which state it was, but they had much lower rates of incapacitated rapes than we found here in the sexual assault nurse examiner study. So in terms...
Senator Wilkowski has a question.
Just to clarify, when you were talking about sexual assaults a number of slides ago, you were referring to, you were considering those forcible rapes? You had a series of slides. You don't have to go back.
That would be forcible rapes and other sex offenses under the Alaska statutes. So it's not using the federal definition. It's using our state definition.
We're kind of bouncing around. So when you were referring to sexual, for instance, you had a whole series of race of sexual assault suspects, age of sexual assault suspects, and those were not just forcible rapes.
Correct.
Okay. Good clarification. Yeah. Thank you.
Through the chair, the only statistics that I have that are linked only to forcible rape are the very early ones from the Uniform Crime Reports. Everything since then has been on sexual assault.
Thank you.
So in terms of victim-suspect relationship, in every single study that we've done, we always find that the most common relationship is friends and acquaintances. And that's also true nationally. The NIBRS is the National Incident-Based Reporting System that looks at sexual assaults reported to law enforcement. They find that 14% of assaults were committed by strangers. And again, the most common relationship was friend or acquaintance, and we find the same as well. The reason I have the NIBRS data here, as Star recently mentioned, that the rate of stranger assaults in Anchorage was higher than the national average. I was not aware of that. But you can see here that 38% of the assaults reported to APD were with strangers compared to the national average of 14%. So there is a pretty striking difference in the likelihood of being assaulted by a stranger in Anchorage relative to national averages. Not surprisingly, in the AST data, we find lower rates of stranger assaults. Because of the smaller communities that we had talked about earlier.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And on that point as well, as you continue to collect data, it would be, I think, also helpful for urban areas like that in Anchorage to find out what are some of the predominant factors in the stranger assaults. Are there certain parts of town that we should be more cautious of and try to improve? Are there lighting issues? Does it tend to be near bars? Does it tend to be the ride acceptance that Senator French was referring to? What kinds of factors lead up to that? Because again, that's part of that prevention piece that I'm hoping we can do a better job at, if nothing else, getting the information out there. I mean, I think a big part of what we're doing and what the chairman is showing leadership on is, you know, just discussing this, and we were discussing this morning on the airplane that a lot of it is just the shame, I think, that Alaskans have felt for so many years, that this is something we all know, we all understand is a problem. It's truly an epidemic, and we feel such shame about it. We don't want to talk about it, and so we're starting to, but as we do, analyzing those factors so that we can get that information out to women and the young people too. You know, it's almost two different categories, because you've got adults who can be conscious about where they, you know, think about things, but with children, you know, what are the safety valves there?
Thank you, through the chair. We did a little bit of work, not a whole lot, looking at the differences between the stranger assaults and the non-stranger assaults that were occurring in Anchorage. Some of that is included on our website. In a nutshell, what I can tell you is that the majority, if we looked at stranger assaults, the majority of those were occurring downtown, and they were occurring outdoors. When we talk about victims taking rides, those are usually from friends and acquaintances. And so one of the messages, though, one of the common prevention messages is be wary of strangers. But in most of the data that we have, you really need to be wary of friends and acquaintances, because they're even more dangerous than strangers. Yeah. But again, the assaults that are occurring downtown are very different than the ones that are occurring elsewhere in the city, and we've focused primarily northeast, where those are almost never between strangers, and they're almost never occurring outdoors. Those are cases that are occurring indoors in private residences. So there are some pretty big differences, and our website would have a little bit more information on that. But that's exactly the type of research that we hope to do in the future, learning more about these types of assaults and the differences that are occurring, and what are the policy implications of those differences. Okay, so focusing now on the Department of Law Studies. Again, we begin with the sexual assault case that's reported to law enforcement, and for this part of the presentation, I'm only going to focus on sexual assault. We have exactly the same data for the stalking and for the domestic violence. Actually, I'll show you a little bit of those, but not in too much detail. So for once we have a sexual assault case that's reported to law enforcement.
Child or adult, right?
Child or adult, right, at this point. Depending on what type of case we're looking at or which study we're looking at, somewhere between 18% to 46% of the reported cases, the cases that are reported to law enforcement, are referred to the Alaska Department of Law for prosecution.
Now let's just stop right there, and it may be that this is the subject of a future hearing or a future, you know, dialogue between the committee and the law enforcement agencies in the state. But you know, it strikes me that right there, there's an enormous amount of good that we can do. There's a huge opportunity there to push those numbers up. And just take one of the studies that I think was on the AST cases, where you have 1,000 reported cases, and I think 46% are referred for prosecution. You know, 540 cases are getting screened out by the troopers, and there may be excellent reasons for screening them out. You know, no identifiable suspect. I mean, if the victim can't point the finger at somebody, you're done, at least for the time being. But it just strikes me that there may be opportunities there for us to work on, either in funding and training, in you know, something that gets those numbers up, because that's a huge sort of, I don't want to say gold mine, but there's lots and lots of cases that are not getting, you know, producing a convicted sex offender because of a variety of factors in that, right, in that particular zone. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And on that point, I agree, including how the cases themselves are handled. And when I was in law school, there was a big push that ultimately was adopted with how children who are victims of sexual assault, they reconfigured the courtroom in such a way that those children felt more comfortable coming forward in terms of being videotaped and not having to be in the room with their accuser. And I've thought for a long time that I wonder how the women in our state feel about that process, and whether or not, while preserving that constitutional right to confront an accuser, if you will, and have a trial, if there aren't some considerations that can be made as well from the judicial branch about how that those victims are handled. My understanding is it's a pretty traumatic,
it has to be, right,
event.
Right. Thank you. So, and just the 46% referred to the AST study, but 18% for APD just seems like an outlier. It seems almost impossible to imagine that they're screening out 82% of the cases at the cop shop on Tudor.
I think I have a footnote of that on one of my next slides. It's really impossible to compare these rates across studies because the cases are so different. And so one of the things that happens in the APD cases, you see a far higher rate of stranger assaults. Those are much more complicated to investigate. Conversely, in the AST cases, we see far greater rates of incapacitated assaults. Those are also difficult to investigate. So because they're completely different cases, to compare those numbers is very difficult.
I think it's probably most productively a future conversation between us and the different agencies. Thank you. Senator McGuire.
Sorry, thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that point, I've thought for a long time, again, being really sensitive about how I phrase this, I've thought for a long time that it might be beneficial to have an independent investigatory unit housed within the Alaska State Troopers that might even be comprised of people that come in a rotation, almost like the CIA or the FBI, that don't necessarily have links or allegiances to particular communities, but rather have specifically trained eyes towards these kinds of assaults. And I've just thought for a long time that perhaps that kind of a unit with a broad sweeping outreach to start prosecuting and really getting in and uncovering some of the things that are happening might be helpful. Just something to file away.
Going back to one of the earlier points about improving the likelihood of a reported case being referred, one of the reasons why that truly is a gold mine is that what these statistics show is that once the case is referred, there's a really good chance it's going to get accepted for prosecution. And once it's accepted for prosecution, there's an even better chance that it will result in a conviction. Now, the only caveat here is, remember, I'm talking about any conviction on any charge, and it may be on a non-sexual assault charge. It could be a trespassing charge. Mm-hmm. For now, we're counting that as a success from prosecution. But with that caveat aside, you can see that once a case is referred, anywhere from 60 to 69% are accepted for prosecution. And once it's accepted, anywhere from 78 to 87% do result in a conviction on at least one charge. So here are the numbers by study. But again, please read the small print here. Cases are not equivalent across studies, so differences across studies should not be interpreted at all in terms of differences in success, because we're looking at completely different cases. The first three are the sexual assault cases. We see that the percent referred varies from 18% to 46%. This is looking at all cases that are reported, so if we look at the percent accepted, the percent of reported cases that are accepted is anywhere from 12 to 28%. The percent of reported cases that go all the way to conviction varies from 11% to 22%. So these statistics are not as bright as the previous ones, which were selecting cases stage by stage. But we look overall at the process, then we clearly see that there definitely is room for improvement. And the best place to improve that, it really is with the percentage of cases that would be referred for law enforcement, for prosecution.
And just to make sure we're all understanding how this works, on the very first line, for example, APD study, 18% referred, 12% accepted. Basically, that means two-thirds of the cases that are referred are being accepted. You're not saying it's only 12%
Correct.
Of those referred, it's 12% of those reported.
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Which is
and then you've almost got a 90% conviction rate of those that are accepted.
Correct.
The Department of Law is getting something out of those cases. Mm-hmm. Right.
Something.
Right.
Can't quite
something.
Tell you
right.
what yet, but something.
Right. Thank you.
I added one little footnote for this presentation. There's a new study by Garner and Maxwell that's coming out, I believe, in the next month or so in 2009. That looks at national averages for prosecution of domestic violence. And one of the best news I can tell you is that if you look at our rates, they are far, far greater than the national averages. 80% of the ASTDV cases were referred for prosecution. 68% were accepted. Over half of them resulted in a conviction. That is a significantly higher, those are significantly higher percentages than what we see at the national average. Mm-hmm. And I think this is a good example, again, where the criminal justice system can work and oftentimes will, and it does work, but there are some little tweaks that we may be looking at. Okay, one of the questions that we're always asked is, do legal resolutions vary by race and by geography? Are victims in rural Alaska less likely to have a conviction in their case than victims in urban Alaska? It's difficult for us as researchers to define what is urban and what is rural. Mm-hmm. So we look at this three different ways. One is we look at whether the victims are Alaska Native or not, with the assumption that if they are, they're more likely to be in rural regions. We also look at whether the cases are from bush Alaska or non-bush Alaska. Bush Alaska is defined as off-the-road system. Non-bush is defined as on-the-road system. And then we also look at whether cases are from remote Alaska, and that would be from places where there is no trooper post, and then compare those to cases that emerge from a location where we do have a trooper post. So by looking at those three different ways, we try to estimate what are the differences by race and geography. And what I can tell you is that by and large, with very, very few exceptions, I think this is one of the only exceptions here, we do not find a difference by victim race. We do not find a difference by geography. We do not find a difference by whether cases are reported from a location where there is a trooper post or not. When we do find those differences, they tend to favor Native victims and rural locations. So the idea that we have under-enforcement in rural Alaska simply does not come out through our studies.
I remember reading that this summer, and that's probably why we're having this hearing today, is because I was so astonished by to get all the way to the end of this 20-page report and come across those conclusions. And I mean, it was I felt very proud of the troopers. I felt proud of the Department of Law. I thought, you know, this is at least something that the public doesn't know and doesn't understand. That many of the myths and the preconceptions we have about this particular topic is that it's an epidemic in the bush, and that law enforcement and the government isn't doing its job out there. And I think this is at least a sort of a piece of good news, if you will, out of this sort of horrible topic that the citizens of the state probably don't know about, that the troopers and the department is doing its job with respect to upholding justice in the bush. So I just, congratulations really to both the representatives from both entities that are here in the audience. Senator McGuire.
Thank you. And on that point, I agree and want to be clear that my remarks earlier weren't meant to disparage the hardworking men and women at the state troopers. But Lieutenant Holloway and I discussed this a little bit this morning as well. It's a good point. However, it doesn't address the nuances, the little subtleties that do occur. You know, and so for an example, you could have a trooper station, but you may have a cultural disposition that does not favor a person making that known to the trooper within that trooper station. So I think that there are, that's enlightening and so forth, and I'm happy to hear it, but I think that there are layers of this as we peel it back that we need to begin to understand is do victims truly feel comfortable approaching a state trooper, and if it's not a state trooper, what kind of a person would it be? Would be vested with that moral authority, if you will, in a community, a safe house, if you will, or a safe place that someone could go, maybe even to get away from the sexual assault at that period of time. So that's just one other thing I hope we can continue to look at is what other models are available to assist our state troopers, who I know are responding to what they can, but if it's not brought out in the light of day, then can't respond.
Good points, both. Thank you.
So I'll just point out a couple of the numbers here. This is looking at whether cases are from on the road system or off the road system, and what you can see is that if they're off the road system, they're never less likely to be founded. They're never less likely to be referred. Never less likely to be accepted. Never less likely to be convicted. Than cases that are on the road system. That's true for all sexual violence, that's true for rape and sexual assault, and it's true for sexual abuse of a minor. And in some cases, the likelihoods are actually higher for both sexual violence and for rape and sexual assault. If we look at whether the case emerged from a place where there is a trooper post, those are the not isolated cases, and compare those to cases that emerge from isolated locations where there is no trooper presence, again, we find the same pattern. The cases from isolated Alaska are never less likely to be founded, never less likely to be referred, they're never less likely to be accepted, and never less likely to be convicted. So I think that's very good.
It's remarkable.
Very good results. So if geography and race don't seem to matter a whole lot, what does make a difference? What I've done is I have four slides here to talk about some of the key factors that we have found through our research, through these four studies that I've talked about and some of the earlier studies that I did not include. And again, I've included in the packet a list of very detailed footnotes about why I'm coming up to these four conclusions. First, enhancing the presence of local professional police, such as VPSOs, VPOs, and TPOs, does make a difference. It clearly reduces rates of serious injury caused by assault by 40%. It also dramatically increases the likelihood of sexual assault cases. If we look at the AST data, we examine whether cases were first reported to troopers or first reported to VPSOs. Cases that were first reported to VPSOs were 2.5 times more likely to be prosecuted. And I think that answers, that provides a little bit.
Say that again.
Let me get my cheat sheet. We compared cases that were first reported to VPSOs to cases that were first reported to Alaska State Troopers. So we examined who was the first responder. And what we found was that when cases were reported to VPSOs, that's actually a typo on my slide. That's 3.5, not 2.5. So when cases were originally reported to VPSOs, they were 3.5 times more likely to be prosecuted than cases that were reported directly to state troopers.
Now that's a fascinating piece of information, and I guess for the can you speculate as to why that's true? Is it just that because the case gets pursued more quickly?
Well, I can speculate on, I think, at least two reasons. One, VPSOs are able to secure crime scenes. So they are able to maintain evidence. They're able to document things much more quickly. And in some cases, if either there's a delay in reporting or a delay in response, there's the possibility that forensic evidence is going to disappear.
Let me just jump in. When you say prosecution, you mean referral or acceptance or some combination of those two?
I'll have to get back to you on that. I believe it was referral.
I just need to know where I am in the gold mine, so to speak. You know,
and
where,
I'm
where
pretty sure it was in the referral.
In referral. Okay, but we'll
pretty
double check.
Sure.
Yep.
So that's one possibility, is the ability to secure the crime scene. The other thing is that VPSOs legitimize the word of the victim, and they have the ability to, they know that the villages sometimes much better than an Alaska State Trooper will be able to. So they're able to connect with witnesses. They're able to organize a lot of the things that are going to happen on the ground before a State Trooper is going to show up to investigate the crime scene. They have more time to investigate the full story rather than just the specific act of violence that occurred on that specific day. So in all of the research that we found, having a VPSO on site is going to be critical. It really does make a difference for prosecution. But it also, on the other side, it does lower the rates of serious injury. And that's somewhat related to prevention. It's not quite the primary prevention, probably, that you're thinking about, but it's a piece of that.
And it's more like intervention than prevention, right? You stop an assault from becoming more severe by giving, you know, immediate aid to someone who's under attack.
Mm-hmm. Right. So that's one of our primary conclusions. Second conclusion is that strengthening local alcohol prohibitions is going to be important. Again, if we look at rates of injury and serious assaults, we find that they're 36% lower in dry villages than in other villages. You've seen all the numbers about the percentages of rapes that are committed against incapacitated victims and how many suspects and offenders were drinking. Prosecution truly is hindered by alcohol use, particularly in the incapacitated cases. It's very difficult to investigate those. But having VPSOs or having greater investigative strategies where we have the time to investigate the entire sequence of events, not just that specific act, often can be quite fruitful. And then in the Randy Megan and Daryl Wood study that I talked about earlier for the victimization survey of Alaska Native women in the Copper River Delta, we found that lifetime victimization dramatically increased with alcohol use. So third, enhancing investigation capacity is something that we've focused on quite a bit. This was one of the reasons why AST was so interested in doing the study. When we had our early conversations with Commissioner Masters and with Colonel Holloway, one of the things they wanted to know is how could they improve their own investigations so that those cases would be more likely to be fully prosecuted. And there are a wide variety of factors that we've identified as important pieces of a successful investigation. Locating and interviewing witnesses seems to make a very big difference in how likely it is that DOL, Department of Law, will subsequently accept cases and will subsequently be able to secure a conviction in those cases. Again, we believe that having VPSOs on site is an important part of locating and interviewing witnesses. Gaining victim cooperation is critically important. That dramatically improves the chance of getting a successful prosecution. But troopers are going to need time to do that. This is not something that you can do by responding to an incident, spending a couple hours investigating the incident, and then doing some follow-up, sometimes on the phone, sometimes not on the phone in person. But if we had more time to devote to those cases, then troopers would have the greater ability to gain victim cooperation. And we will see dramatic improvements in referral rates, conviction rates through the Alaska Department of Law. Yes, the problem with that is that is going to add to the cost, but keep in mind that any time you're removing an offender from society and putting that offender through the court system, we are going to eventually decrease our rate of forcible rape in the state of Alaska, and that will lead to a reduction in cost. One of the things that was important through the AST studies was looking at how much time troopers had to investigate cases. And one of the things that we found out is if they were able to close a case within 16 days, if they had enough time to fully investigate it and close it, that also made a difference. Cases were more likely to be referred to prosecution if cases were able to be closed within 16 days. But when cases were not closed that quickly, then the legal resolutions began to deteriorate over time. And then finally, promoting access to sexual assault nurse examiners is a factor that we've always found is important. Medical forensic exams of sexual assault victims in the AST trooper data. When medical forensic exams were conducted, they more than doubled the likelihood that cases would be accepted for prosecution. And when we examined the sexual assault nurse examiner data and tracked those cases through the legal system, we found that it was mostly the documentation of physical injury that was particularly important. That's what did it. That's what caused a dramatic increase in legal resolutions. This is really pretty fascinating for us because most states do not have empirical evidence to support the importance of sexual assault nurse examiners. But even when we don't have that evidence, I do want to emphasize that sexual assault nurse examiners do offer the best standard of care. And anything less than that is simply unacceptable. So even if they had no impact on prosecution, we would still want to have sexual assault nurse examiners in the state. Fortunately, here in Alaska, we actually have the ability to show that they do make a difference with prosecution. Again, they more than doubled the likelihood that cases would be accepted for prosecution.
Yeah. I just can't help but sit here and think that if you had a sexual assault nurse examiner in every village working with the VPSOs, you know, you'd begin to crush these cases because you'd have, you know, swift gathering of powerful evidence of the crime.
I think I would agree. One thing I'll emphasize, sexual assault nurse examiners are highly trained. They're difficult to get here in the state. We have a pretty severe problem with sustainability. So it's a tough challenge, but it's one that's likely to be fruitful. The other piece of that, and again, I'm not talking about this.
Senator McGuire and I are going to be the co-chairs of the Finance Committee. We'll fix that.
Yes, we will. Coming. Thank you, through the chair. On that point, there is a concept, I'm sure you know of it, called traveling nurses. And a lot of the folks that rely on nurses in our state are going to this model. And frankly, nurses that could go anywhere in the nation that come up for an opportunity to live in a unique environment. So one idea might be to consider adding on a few more of these folks in the traveling nurse arena that could sort of track and move throughout rural Alaska and partner alongside the VPSOs is just a thought.
Through the chair, there's also great advances in telemedicine, which I'm not too familiar with, but that's something that you might want to explore as well.
Interesting. Yep. Thank you.
And then the last piece that I'll add to your earlier comments about the VPSOs and the nurses, keep in mind that the third part of that is having victim advocacy present. And again, I'm not talking about that because I'm really focusing on the criminal justice response, but that is an essential part of that response that is not included in here. And why does this matter? Last line, it matters because we, I think contrary to what some people might believe, the recidivism of sex offenders is actually no different than the recidivism of non-sex offenders. We find that both in the adult system and also in the juvenile justice system. The McLaughlin Youth Center recently did an evaluation of their sex offender treatment program and found very low rates of recidivism. And they even tracked those kids through into the adult system. Here what we did, this was Alan McKelvey, the director of the Statistical Analysis Center with the UAA Justice Center within my office. We looked, or he looked at the recidivism of offenders that were released from the Alaska Department of Corrections in 2001 and tracked those for 3 years. So I guess I'll begin with the bad news. Bad news is only 39% were not rearrested. So 61% were rearrested. 40% were rearrested and reconvicted. 21% were rearrested, but they were not reconvicted. The good news is there was absolutely no difference between sex offenders and non-sex offenders. They recidivated and were reconvicted at the same rates. And there was no difference in the likelihood of being rearrested for a second sex offense. Both the sex offenders and the non-sex offenders were exactly the same.
I don't know if I call it good news, but I know what you mean. We have a fairly bad recycling of criminals through the system. But I understand your point. It's no more worse for sex offenders than it is for thieves, drug addicts, DWI offenders, and so forth. Senator McGuire, closing thoughts?
Yeah. Through the chair, I accept the data. It's just very contrary to data that I have been exposed to with lower 48 rates of recidivism for the sex offender population. It's just, it's surprising to me, and it sort of makes me question a lot of the assumptions that I've made about things. I mean, going down the route of the containment project and those things, I don't know. But I would agree with you that that it's, I guess, slightly better news. I'd be curious for you to continue to study that area.
But through the chair, I think what's happening here, because I'm well aware of there are lots and lots of studies that have repeatedly shown that sex offenders recidivate at a much higher risk. And I think what's happening is those are old studies. And the treatment of sex offenders has dramatically improved over the last 20 years, and we've now figured it out. And if you are able to successfully treat a sex offender, you can end up with recidivism rates that are no different than those for non-sex offenders. And again, that's particularly true with the juvenile justice system.
That study, I was going to offer a different reason, which is that we're punting sex offenders off to prison for a longer period of time that may make them, consequence of which is that they may think twice when they get out about reoffending. But that's an old study. That's from 8 years ago. So I guess I'd be interested in maybe more updated data.
Yeah, and the only problem there, and keep in mind, is we're only looking in all of these numbers. We're only looking at what's reported to law enforcement. And we know that
even worse than that, I mean, if there are 1,000 reported, we're only looking at 200 of those individuals, right, that eventually get convicted. So you're looking at one, fifth of those reported, maybe as low as one-tenth of those that take place. So it's difficult to draw broad conclusions over what a fairly narrow population, although even there's going to be some overlap, right? Of those 200 people convicted, chances are they've performed some of those other sex crimes that either didn't get reported or did get reported and weren't referred, or if you see what I'm saying, it's probably the case that there's a lot of overlap between the people we eventually imprison and the number of crimes that take place out in the rest of the state. But let me just say I'm really glad you came down. I appreciate you flying down in Juneau. This is an enormously valuable resource. There's a lot of talk that goes on about this problem, but numbers are sometimes, give us more opportunity to make improvements than just the myths that creep up around the topic. Further comments or questions? We've met you. We know who you are. I'm sure we'll all be in touch with our various follow-ups. But again, thank you for coming down to Juneau. And with that, we are adjourned.